Last week we left off with the prophecy of the Messiah being given through Judah. That was some of Jacob's last words whenever he said that the Messiah would come through his son Judah. And I did miss one part of the war, I guess, that I didn't think about until this morning, and I just jotted down a couple of notes. I wish I would have included this in the outline, but before the prophecy was given of Judah, Satan didn't know which of the children of Jacob, of Israel, would the lineage of the Messiah come through. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about Joseph. And if you think about it, if you remember the story of Joseph, Joseph was Jacob's favorite child, his favorite son, right? And so if you're the devil and you're looking among the sons of Jacob to try to figure out which one to persecute, which one the Messiah might come through, you might look at the favorite one, right? He was given the coat of many colors because it said flat out that he was his father's favorite. And then you remember Joseph had these dreams. And he dreams that the were sheaves in the field and all of the sheaves, there were, well, I forget, 12 sheaves and they all, or 11 sheaves, I think, and they all bowed down to his sheaf, which was his brothers bowing down to him. And then the sun, moon, and the stars were all making obeisance to him was another one of his dreams. And it was obvious to everybody that the sheaves were his brothers and that the sun, moon, and stars were his father and mother and his brethren. They all recognized this and they hated him for it. So by all accounts, it certainly looks like that if the promised Messiah is going to come through anybody, it's going to come through Joseph, right? The one that his brothers are all bowing down to, right? And the favorite of his father. And so who does Satan persecute? Who gets persecuted out of the 12 patriarchs of Israel? It was Joseph. His father sends him out into the field to check on his brethren. And when his brothers see him coming, they want to kill him. They say, you know, we'll take care of this dreamer and see what happens to him then. And when they do that, Reuben decides that when he's coming that they wouldn't kill him. What's the point of killing him? You know, they'll maybe just take him captive or something. And then it's interesting that whenever he comes and they throw him in the pit, if you look in Genesis 37, 26 through 27, the brother that decides not to kill him was actually Judah, which is interesting enough. In Genesis 37, 26 through 27, it says, "And Judah said unto his brethren, What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh, and his brethren were content." So we know that the Messiah is going to come through Judah. And it's just interesting that Judah is the one that decides to preserve Joseph's life. I just thought that was curious for whatever that's worth. So Joseph ends up being sold into slavery to the Ishmaelites, and they sell him to a guy named Potiphar in Egypt, and he ends up becoming a servant in Potiphar's house. And then he did such a good job that Potiphar made him his butler, basically, or second in command of his house. And that went well for Joseph until Potiphar's wife takes a liking to Joseph, and she tries to seduce him, and he flees from her, and she makes up this story about how he tried to rape her, and Potiphar doesn't like that, so he has Joseph tossed into prison. And then Joseph's in prison, and it's not looking well for Joseph again, and he does such a good job that he gets to become head of the prison. And then the butler and the baker of Pharaoh are thrown into prison too for, I don't know, some crime. I don't remember what that was. And they have these dreams. And Joseph interprets the dreams, to make a long story short. And he basically tells the butler, the baker, I think the baker was the one with the birds eating the bread out of his hat, I'm pretty sure. The baker was the one that was going to be killed by Pharaoh, and the butler was going to be restored to his office. And sure enough, that's what happens. And Joseph tells those guys, or tells the butler, whenever you're restored, remember me. Well, he forgot about Joseph. But then Pharaoh has this dream. And he sees these seven stalks of corn, and some of them are fat, and the other ones are blasted with the east wind, or the south wind, or whichever one it was, I don't remember. And then he sees these seven lean cows and seven fat cows, and the seven lean cows eat up the seven fat cows, and He doesn't know what to make of this dream. And then the butler remembers, oh, I remember Joseph can interpret dreams. This guy in the prison, the one that told me to remember him that I forgot. So they call Joseph, and he goes to the Pharaoh, and he interprets these dreams. And he tells the Pharaoh that the seven fat ears of corn and the seven fat cows are seven fat years. The earth's going to bring forth plenty. And then the seven lean ears of corn, the seven lean beeves are the years of drought that they're going to be. And the years of drought are going to be so bad that they're going to eat up all the years of plenty. So everything that you've laid up in the seven good years are going to be eaten up in the seven bad years. Pharaoh is so impressed with this that he makes Joseph the prime minister of Egypt, second in command of all of the land of Egypt, and puts him in charge of the agricultural program. Through Joseph, then, and through his wisdom, they end up laying up all that produce in those 7 years. And then when the 7 years of famine come, they're able to keep the Egyptians alive. And guess who else they're able to keep alive? Joseph's family. Joseph's family in Canaan come down to Egypt because they heard there's corn in Egypt. And they get corn there. Long story short, they don't recognize Joseph. Joseph recognizes them. He holds back one of the brothers, sends them back to their dad, tells them he wants them to bring their little brother, Benjamin. He hasn't seen Benjamin for a long time. They end up bringing Jacob back and all of his house, all 70 of them, to Egypt and giving them a place in the land of Goshen to live in Egypt and to live out the rest of Jacob's days and all of their days. So, interestingly enough, it appears to me that Satan was persecuting Joseph because he was the favorite child of Jacob, and he was the one that the Messiah would come through. And through that persecution, talk about a picture of the Lord Jesus Christ, through persecuting Joseph, trying to stop the Messiah from coming, he inadvertently saves Jacob and his entire family, including Judah, whom the Messiah would actually come through. Because if he wouldn't have persecuted Joseph, chances are they would have all died of starvation in those 7 years of famine, and no Messiah. But thanks to Satan and his tactics, it appears to me, he ends up saving, through God's providence, of course, ends up saving alive the very man that he had hoped to kill, which was ultimately Judah, ultimately the progenitor of the Messiah, whom he'd hoped to kill, and he ends up saving him alive. So I thought that was pretty fascinating, and that kind of makes sense, because the prophecy of Judah wasn't given until the end of Jacob's life, until he's already in Egypt. So at the time when Satan persecuted Joseph, he didn't know that Judah was going to be, you know, the progenitor of the Messiah. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So that takes us up to Israel being in Egypt now. And they were there, as I mentioned last time, 215 years. And Satan tries to destroy them in Egypt before they ever make it to the Promised Land. And then when they leave Egypt, he tries to destroy them on their way out of Egypt before they get to the Promised Land. And then when they get to the Promised Land, he tries to destroy them. And we're going to look at some of that today. So for much of the time that Israel dwelt in Egypt, they were slaves there, and they were under cruel bondage. If you look in Exodus 6 and verse 9, this verse tells us of their state. We also read about it at the scripture reading before the sermon today in Exodus chapter 1. We read about how Pharaoh put them into cruel bondage because they were multiplying in Egypt. But in Exodus 6 and verse 9, it says, "And Moses spake unto the children of Israel, but they hearkened not unto Moses for anguish of spirit and for cruel bondage." And this had been going on for a long time. Not this, when Moses was speaking to them, they'd been, I mean, this is the tail end of them being in Egypt, but they had been under bondage for a long time since the time that they started to multiply in Egypt. We read about that in Exodus 1:7, "And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them." And so then the new Pharaoh arises, and he doesn't like this, and he's afraid that Egypt is going to be taken over by these immigrants, basically, and he decides to put them under bondage and persecute them so that they aren't able to rise up against them if one of their enemies come in against them. We read about that in Exodus chapter 1. So when Israel is multiplying in Egypt, then Pharaoh orders that all the baby boys are to be killed. So after he puts them into bondage and that didn't work, and they're still multiplying like rabbits, then he decides that he will kill all the baby boys, and that will put an end to the multiplication. If you don't have any baby boys, you don't end up with any baby girls or boys in another generation. So in Exodus, at least any Israelite babies, the Egyptians could have taken them for themselves, the wives, the women, I suppose. But in Exodus 1, in verse 15 and 16, it says, "And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, When you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, and if it be a daughter, then ye shall, or then she, I'm sorry, then she shall live." So he tells the midwives here that you just pay attention, and if it's a boy, you kill him, and if it's a girl, you let him live. And I think this is interesting, and not that I'm a doctor, not that I know a thing about giving birth or pregnancy or anything, but it is interesting there that he said, when you see them upon the stools, and, you know, in today's culture, women give birth, this is totally a side note, but they give birth, what, laying in a bed, horizontal, right? Not letting gravity help them, don't they? They don't? Oh, I thought they did. Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'm wrong. I thought they laid in a bed. Okay, I thought some did anyway. Anybody? Anybody know? Anybody know?
I did.
They laid in a bed?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's what I thought. Well, a lot of them do anyway. They lay in a bed, and does that make any sense? Because gravity is not even helping you out or anything there. But these ones were on a stool. And I know some of them, they have them sit on the brown balls and things, you know, prior to going into labor and all that, and helps it out. But anyway, I just thought that was interesting that it seems like, you know, modern medicine and all of its, you know, amazing wisdom hasn't figured out what the Egyptians did, you know, 4,000 years ago or whatever, how to get babies popping out as fast as possible and causing the least amount of pain as possible. But anyway, that's beside the point. Let's see. So anyway, so Pharaoh tells the midwives to kill the baby boys. Who do you suppose might have inspired Pharaoh to do that? Remember Satan, John 8:44, he was a murderer from the beginning, right? Maybe Satan inspired him to do that, I would say. But the midwives feared God. They disobeyed Pharaoh's order in Exodus 1 and verse 17. Exodus 1:17. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. So thankfully, these women exercised what you call civil disobedience, and they did not obey the king, because what the king told them to do was murder. It was reprehensible, and they didn't do that. And so Satan ends up losing another battle, because if he could have done that, if he could have just wiped out all the baby boys, well, there's going to be no Messiah born if he could get them all. And it's interesting, Satan, he tries the same tactics over and over again. And we'll talk about this a little bit later. But there was another time in Israel's history where Satan inspired a king to murder all the baby boys of the land again to try to stop the Messiah from being born. So this is a tactic of Satan. And if you think about it, and I just kind of thought about this, we know for sure that Herod, tried to kill all the baby boys in Israel to stop the Messiah being born. And that's without controversy, right? Who inspired him to do that? Obviously, Satan inspired him to do that. So if that's the case, who do you suppose inspired Pharaoh to kill all the baby boys to prevent the Messiah from being born? It really makes sense to me that Satan was obviously behind this. Then after Pharaoh finally lets Israel go, he pursued them and had them cornered at the Red Sea. So Satan loses the battle with the babies, okay, but the war's not over yet. He's going to yet try to destroy Israel, and he's almost got them this time. I mean, he was within, barring a supernatural miracle, Israel would have been wiped out entirely. Exodus 14, 5 through 10. It's got to be so frustrating to be the devil, I would think, because just time and again, he's so close, and then God does something like parting a sea, which of course has never happened in the history of mankind, and saving his people. Exodus 14, 5 through 10. It says, "And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and of his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we let Israel go from serving us? He's having a little bit of buyer's remorse or seller's remorse, I suppose. And he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. And he took 600 chosen chariots and all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with an high hand. But the Egyptians pursued after them all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, encamping by the sea beside Pihahiroth, before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid, and the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. So here they are. The Lord has delivered them out of the hand of Pharaoh. They're marching out through the wilderness, and they turn around, and here is the most powerful military on the face of the earth coming right on their heels, ready to destroy them, and they're scared to death. It looks like Satan is going to destroy them all. He's going to win the war. I mean, he's got them. He's got them cornered. They're totally cornered. Right here is the Red Sea on the other side, and Pharaoh's army has them. How is God possibly going to pull this one off? But God just parts the Red Sea, parts the waters, and Israel walks across on dry land, and he drowns the Egyptians. Exodus 14, 21 through 31. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. You would think that enough right there would have caused Pharaoh's men to just consider, like, wow, this ocean just divided and there's dry ground there. And, you know, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe these people have some special relationship with the Almighty and we might not want to pursue them anymore. But, you know, wicked people don't think like that. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them to the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch the Lord looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians, and took off their chariot wheels, and they drave them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, from the Lord, for the Lord fighteth for them against the Egyptians." And the Lord said unto Moses, "Stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen." And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it. And the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore, and Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. So what a miraculous deliverance here. And this deliverance is referred to time and again throughout the Bible. God constantly reminds his people about how he saved them out of the land of Egypt through the Red Sea. There are skeptics out there that say that this was the Reed Sea or the Sea of Reeds, and it was only very like ankle deep water or something like that, and that's how Israel was able to get across it. Well, let me ask you a question. When's the last time you saw an Egyptian army drowned in ankle deep water? Idiots. People like that just drive me nuts. If you don't believe the Bible, just say you don't believe it. You know, don't try to make up some alternate explanation or something. Just say you just don't believe it. It's just a lie and move on with your life. So Satan loses another battle. He thought he had them. I mean, they were dead to rights. How in the world were they going to escape that? And the Lord parts the sea and their enemies are drowned. So then Israel makes it to the border of the promised land, but they're afraid to go in. They doubt that God will be able to do what he said, and the Lord makes them wander in the wilderness for a whole generation until they all die, until all the fighting age men die. Look in Numbers 13, 1 through 2. So once again, Satan is up to his old tricks. Because who do you suppose inspired the fear and unbelief in them? Go ahead and turn to Numbers 13. Who inspired the fear and unbelief in them? Well, it certainly wasn't God. God is not the author of fear, right? He's not the author of confusion. He hath not given us the spirit of fear, we're told in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 7. Who made them fear? Well, I would say Satan put that fear in their hearts, made them to doubt, trying to get God to destroy them. Numbers 13, 1 through 2. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Send thou men, that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel, of every tribe of their fathers, shall ye send a man, every one a ruler among them. So Moses sends them into the land. Verses 26 through 33. Here's what happened. It says, And they went and came to Moses and Aaron. This is after they come back, when they had been done surveying the land. And to all the congregation of the children of Israel, unto the wilderness of Paran, to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. That was those great big grapes that they had to carry back between two men. And they told him and said, We came unto the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. Moreover, we saw the children of Anak there, and the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and in the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are able to overcome it. See, Caleb was a man of faith. But the men that went up with him said, We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of a great stature. And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, so we were in their sight. So Caleb tells them, let's go up and take it. Caleb says, don't you guys remember just like no time ago, the Lord parted the Red Sea, for goodness sakes. He saved us from the most powerful military in the face of the earth. You don't think that he's able to destroy the Canaanites? Caleb is a man of faith. He's taking God at his word, and so did Joshua. But they feared. And because they feared, God made them wander in the wilderness for 40 years. A year for a day. He sent them into the land to spy it out for 40 days, and they came back and rejected God, and God made them wander in the wilderness a year for a day, 40 years. Numbers 14, 28 through 35. Numbers 14, 28 through 35. And say unto them, As truly as I live, saith the Lord, as ye have spoken in mine ears, so will I do to you. Your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and all that were numbered of you according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against me, doubtless ye shall not come into the land concerning which I swear to make you dwell therein, save Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. But your little ones, which ye said should be a prey, them will I bring in, and they shall know the land which ye have despised. But as for you, your carcasses, they shall fall in this wilderness. And your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your whoredoms until your carcasses be wasted in the wilderness. So the Lord was going to punish them for this. Let's keep reading a couple more verses. And after the number of the days in which ye searched the land, even 40 days each day for a year, shall ye bear your iniquities even 40 years, and ye shall know my breach of promise. And the Lord have said, I will surely do it unto all this evil congregation that are gathered together against me in this wilderness. They shall be consumed, and there they shall die. So this is kind of what I assume Satan was hoping would happen, except he wanted God to just be fed up with him and destroy them all. But God didn't destroy them all. God destroyed the men that rejected him. He didn't destroy the children that didn't have any part in it. He, all that whole generation that rejected him and disbelieved him, they died, but their children would inherit the land. So Satan has lost another battle here. Now, while in the wilderness, they continued to murmur against God. They tempted him and brought God to the brink of destroying them. Who do you suppose might have been behind that? It's just Satan just keeps trying to get God to destroy them over and over again. What he can't do through outright persecution, he'll try to do by getting God's people to get lax in their faith toward him and adopt another religion and then have God destroy them for their lack of faith. So if he can't get them one way, he tries to get them another way. Let's look at Psalm 106 and verse 19. I'm going to read a little passage here and just give you a little bit of history and just show you what happened to Israel while they were wandering in the wilderness and how Satan's trying to get God to destroy them. Psalm 106, 19 through 34. Here's what happens with Israel in the wilderness. It says, "And they made a calf in Horeb and worshiped the molten image." You remember the golden calf that Aaron made. That's what this is referring to. "Thus they changed their glory, that is God, into the similitude of an ox that eateth grass. They forgat God their Savior, which had done great things in Egypt, wondrous works in the land of Ham, and terrible things by the Red Sea. Therefore he said that he would destroy them, had not Moses his chosen stood before him in the breach to turn away his wrath, lest he should destroy them." I mean, there was times where God was so ready to destroy them, but even then, God wasn't just going to wipe them out entirely. He was going to destroy them all, keep Moses alive, and then create another nation through Moses. And he still would have kept his promise. It still would have been the seed of the woman the Messiah could have come through. He could have done it another way. But he didn't do that. Moses stood in the breach, and the Lord had mercy. "Yea, they despised the pleasant land. They believed not his word, but murmured in their tents and hearkened not unto the voice of the Lord. Therefore he lifted up his hand against them to overthrow them in the wilderness, to overthrow their seed also among the nations and to scatter them in the lands. They joined themselves also unto Baal Peor and ate the sacrifices of the dead. Thus they provoked him to anger with their inventions, and the plague brake in upon them. Then stood up Phinehas and executed judgment, and so the plague was stayed." That's when Phinehas shish kebabbed those two fornicators, if you remember, in the tent. "And that was counted unto him for righteousness, unto all generations forevermore. They angered him also at the waters of strife, so it went ill with Moses for their sakes, because they provoked his spirit, so that he spake unadvisedly with his lips." So the children of Israel, let me read one more verse here. They did not destroy the nations concerning whom the Lord commanded them. So you can see here the working of Satan happening here, because he's tempting them to serve other gods, which will incur the wrath of God against them. But God didn't quite destroy them. Then in the meantime, Satan has lots of time to corrupt the nations in the land of Canaan so that they can corrupt Israel with their idolatry when Israel gets into Canaan. So Satan's working on them in the wilderness, trying to get God to destroy them in the wilderness. And in case that doesn't work, then he's making future plans in the land of Canaan, making these people into idolaters, or increasing their idolatry, I suppose, and preparing them a place to corrupt Israel when they get there, to have God destroy them when they get into the land. So it's kind of a multi-fronted battle here. Let's read verses 35 through 46. "But were mingled among the heathen, and learned their works, and they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils, and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan. And the land was polluted with blood." This is after they're in the land. "Thus they were defiled with their own works and went whoring with their own inventions. Therefore was the wrath of the Lord kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance." This is precisely, I'm sure, what Satan was hoping for. God hates his own people. They're so full of sin and idolatry. And he gave them into the hand of the heathen, and they that hated ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their hand. Many times did he deliver them, but they provoked him with their counsel, and were brought low for their iniquity. Nevertheless, he regarded their affliction when he heard their cry, and he remembered for them his covenant, and repented according to the multitude of his mercies. He made them also to be pitied of all those that carried them captives. So even despite all that, the Lord remembers his covenant for them. Think about that. Most people think that salvation is up to us, and we have to put our faith in God, and we have to remember God's covenant. We have to do our part, or else God's just going to cast us off and throw us into hell. God remembered his covenant for them because they forgot it. He, through his grace and mercy, continued to save them. So Satan was able to corrupt them and put them under God's judgment, but he was not able to succeed in completely destroying them. And that's pretty much the history of the nation of Israel. Continually corrupting them, but not able to totally destroy them. They get under God's judgment, then eventually when it's so bad they repent, and then God delivers them, and the cycle goes on and on throughout history. So Israel ends up making it to the promised land and inhabiting all of it. Joshua 1 and verse 43. Joshua 21, 43. This is a good verse to kind of have highlighted and underlined in your Bible. And probably the majority of you aren't going to run into people that are going to give you trouble on this. But there are people out there, dispensationalists or some of them, that say that Israel never actually inherited all the land that God gave them. Therefore, that God gave them the land, in 1948 again, and they inherited it all, or they're going to inherit it all eventually, because they never really got what God had promised to them. That is nonsense. They got every last square inch of land that God promised them. So there is no future promise of the land to Israel. Joshua 21 and verse 43. And the Lord gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. So if you've got a problem with that, then take it up with God, because he said he gave it all to them. Now, while in the land, they're ruled by judges, and they have God as their king. Acts 13:19-20. Acts 13:19-20. And Satan had plenty of opportunity to really corrupt Israel during this period as well. If you read through the book of Judges, and you'll read numerous times, there was no king in the land in those days, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And just continually through Judges, the people rebel against God, and then God allows them to be taken over by their oppressors, the Philistines or other nations. And then in their affliction, they cry unto the Lord, and he raises them up a judge, like a Gideon, like a Jephthah, like a Deborah, numerous ones. And he saves them out of the hand of their enemies, and they have 40 years or how many ever years of peace and prosperity. And then same old thing happens again. They get comfortable. They start to reject the Lord. They get brought under the subjection of their enemies again, and God raises up another judge. And this happens over and over again. This went on for 450 years, Acts 13:19-20. This part of the sermon is kind of just a little history lesson on the nation of Israel. So if you had forgotten some of these details, maybe this will help refresh your memory. Acts 13:19-20. And when he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he divided their land to them by lot. And after that, he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. Now, I just have to mention this. I guess I can't read this passage without mentioning it. The NIV says that all this took 450 years, them destroying the Canaanites out of the land, which the Bible says took 7 years. The NIV says that all that took 450 years, and after that, God gave them judges to rule over them. That's what the NIV says. So it is demonstrably false. That is a provable error, an internal error within the NIV. It says if you read the NIV itself, you can read back through the Judges and see that, or read back through Joshua and see that it did not take 450 years to destroy the nations in the land of Canaan, that it was 450 years that the Judges ruled. So anyway, the NIV is just flat out wrong there. It's just internally, you don't even need the King James to prove that. It internally contradicts itself. In one place, it says that it was 450 years, and then when you look back at the actual history, it's like 7 years. So anyway, that's just one to keep in your ammo can, I guess, whenever you want to show somebody the errors of the non-inspired version. And during this time, when the Judges ruled, God was their king. 1 Samuel 12 and verse 12. And then we're going to see that Satan had other plans for that. He didn't want God to be their king. And they end up getting into trouble whenever they reject God as their king. 1 Samuel 12 and verse 12. And when ye saw, this is Samuel speaking to Israel, and when ye saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, ye said unto me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord God was your king. They had a king. It was God. But they wanted a king like the nations. They wanted to be like everybody else. They wanted to have a king that would go out and fight their wars for them. And boy, that's what they got, a lot of wars. They wanted to have a king to rule over them, and that's what they got. A king to rule over them with rigor. Acts 13:21, when they clamored for a king, God set Saul, the son of Cis, over them. Acts 13 and verse 21. Remember, if you clamor and murmur enough to God and complain about what you want, he may actually give it to you. So just be careful. If you keep asking God for what you want, he may give it to you. So you better be careful of what you want and what you complain about. Acts 13 and verse 21. And afterward they desired a king, and God gave unto them Saul the son of Cis, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. So Satan continually tried to keep them as far away from God as possible so that he could corrupt and destroy them and prevent the promised Messiah from being born. But he's just not able to do it. He wasn't able to succeed. Though he tried so much, and so many times God was ready to just wipe him off the face of the earth, but God would not do that because he had greater plans. So now we get down to the kings. We get down to a man named David. Now, by this point, once again, it is broadened out a lot, right? Remember, as we look through this history, it starts out narrow, seed of the woman, and then it broadens out. And then it narrows back down again with Noah and his family. And then it broadens out again. And then it narrows back down with Abraham. And then we get Isaac. And then we get Jacob. And then it broadens out with his 12 sons. And then it narrows back down with Judah. And then it broadens back out because Judah's got unknown, untold numbers of kids now. And so now it's broad. And Satan knows it's the tribe of Judah, but who isn't in the tribe of Judah? We don't know. But then there's a prophecy that the Messiah would come through King David. Let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 12. Because the devil doesn't know which son of Judah is the Messiah going to come through yet. 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16. But now the Lord reveals, and he does this publicly. If Satan's around paying attention, and it says that he walketh about seeking whom he may devour, whenever Satan went up to the Lord there in the book of Job, and he says, what are you doing? And he says, I've been running to and fro in the earth. Right? I mean, Satan, he's running around out there all the time paying attention, so I don't have any doubt that he was aware of this statement because it was said right there to David, audibly in his ears, by Nathan the prophet. So 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16 says, and when thy day, this is the prophecy that Nathan the prophet gave unto King David. He said, and when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men, and with the stripes of the children of men. but my mercy shall not depart away from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever." So this is what you call the Davidic covenant, the covenant that was given to David. And he tells David that a seed would proceed out of his bowels, like one of his natural physical descendants would be given God's throne, and God would establish his kingdom with this descendant forever. So now we've drawn it down. We know that the Messiah, the promised Messiah, is going to come through David. There's no doubt about that. Let's look at one more verse, Psalm 132 and verse 11. Show you that God made this covenant with David, that the Messiah would come through him. Psalm 132 and verse 11. Psalm 132:11, "And the Lord has sworn in truth unto David, he will not turn from it. Of the fruit of thy body will I set upon thy throne." The fruit of his body, so it's going to be his physical descendant that God would set on the throne. So now the field's narrowed. Now Satan knows who he has to focus the attacks on. It's David and on David's descendants. Now this is quite interesting. 2 Samuel chapter 7, the Davidic covenant is given. And God says that one of David's descendants is going to sit on his throne. Hardly any time passes and Satan tempts David to commit adultery. I don't think this is a coincidence. Not much time. Let's see, four chapters pass. 2 Samuel chapter 11, 1 through 5. Four chapters pass. I'm not sure exactly how much time this was. I didn't look through and calculate that carefully, but not much time passes. It seems like as soon as Satan finds out that the Messiah is coming through David, he tries to destroy David right away. 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 5, David sees this woman Bathsheba bathing on her rooftop. He calls for her, commits adultery with her. 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 5, "And it came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants unto him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still at Jerusalem, not out there with his men in the field." You know, if presidents, kings, and rulers would actually do what the old-time kings did and go out into the field with their soldiers and go to war with their soldiers, we wouldn't be having these wars today. Do you think for one second George Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, you think those guys are going to be on the front line fighting a war? For goodness sakes. It's real easy to wage war when you're sitting in the White House. You're sitting on Air Force One, bombing the crap out of a bunch of people on the other side of the planet that you never even met or know anything about. That's real easy to do. But boy, if they were on the front line, that wouldn't be happening. That's what they should do. They should pass a law that the president, as commander-in-chief, must be actually the commander-in-chief on the front line. You want to go attack another country? You get in the Humvee and you lead the way. Anyway. See, if David would have been out there fighting the war, he wouldn't have, and maybe he shouldn't have been fighting the war, I don't know, but anyway, he wouldn't have committed adultery with Bathsheba if he wouldn't have been sending his men out there and tarrying back in Jerusalem. Anyway. "And it came to pass in an eventide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. And David sent and inquired after the woman, and one said, Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned unto her house. And the woman conceived, and sent and told David, and said, I am with child." I do not think this is a coincidence that the Davidic covenant was given to David, and almost immediately he sees a woman out there on the housetop, and he's tempted. Why was she out there bathing naked anyway on the housetop? Who knows? But she's out there bathing naked for some reason on the housetop, and David sees that and calls her and commits adultery with her. I do not think that that was a coincidence. I think that the devil put that temptation there. Why would I think that the devil gave him that temptation? Because the devil's called the tempter. That's what he's called. Look at Matthew 4 and verse 3. Matthew 4 and verse 3. I can tell you one thing. I can tell you definitely who didn't tempt David to do that. It certainly wasn't the Lord that tempted him to do that. We're told that God tempteth no man with evil in the book of James. So we certainly know it wasn't the Lord. Well, who would have tempted him? Maybe the tempter tempted him. Matthew 4 and verse 3. And when the tempter came to him, that is to Jesus, he said, if thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. That's one of the names, remember? In this series, I don't know, months ago or a long time ago, we looked at the names and titles of Satan. The tempter is one of them. So yeah, Satan tempted David to commit adultery. David then has Bathsheba's husband Uriah murdered. Look at 2 Samuel 11, 14 through 17. This is the problem with sin. One sin leads to another sin, right? He commits adultery. Now he's got to cover this up because there's no way that Bathsheba can be pregnant whenever her husband's out in the field, right? When her husband's fighting a war, she's not going to be pregnant unless some other guy did it. And he's got to cover this thing up now. 2 Samuel 11, 14 through 17. It's like the sin of lying, right? If you lie, then you have to tell more lies to cover up your old lies. And then you have to have a really good memory, and you have to remember the lies that you told, and you have to make sure your story stays consistent. And eventually, when you tell enough lies, and the story gets so out of control that you just can't remember it all, and it's not internally consistent because it's not true. See, the thing is about the truth, it's always consistent. So if you always stick to the truth and always tell the truth, there's never a point where you're going to be like, what am I going to say now? Because you just say the truth, whatever the truth is, and the truth always fits together with itself. But lies can't fit together with themselves because eventually it just gets to the point where you just can't maintain this thing because the thing is not corresponding to reality. So anyway, that's just one reason not to lie. The main reason is because it's sin and God hates it. So, I mean, I don't even need to explain to you how much trouble you can get in for it. You shouldn't do it just because it's sin. Anyway, 2 Samuel 11, 14 through 17. And it came to pass in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab, that was one of his commanders out there in the field, and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter, saying, set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and retire ye from him, that he may be smitten and die. And it came to pass, when Joab observed the city, that he assigned Uriah unto a place where he knew that valiant men were. And the men of the city went out and fought with Joab, and there fell some of the people of the servants of David. And Uriah the Hittite died also. This was an act of murder. David didn't actually kill the man himself physically, but David arranged his death. David killed this man to cover up his sin. And the whole world knows about it. You think about that. The next time you think you're going to get away with something, we think that nobody's going to know. David probably thought nobody's going to know, and preachers have been preaching about it for thousands of years and will continue to until the end of time. Now, who do you suppose inspired David to plot Uriah's murder? Who's the murderer from the beginning, right? John 8 and verse 44, Satan was a murderer from the beginning. Who do you suppose inspired that? Who do you suppose inspired David to lie about committing adultery with Bathsheba, which is essentially what he's doing, is lying, right? Satan's a liar, the father of it. The thing is, Satan would have known that the penalty for adultery and for murder is death. Satan knows the Bible just like you and I know the Bible. I can prove he knows the Bible. Remember the temptation of Christ? And he takes him to Psalm 91. And he said, jump off the temple, for he'll give his angels charge concerning thee, and they shall bear thee up, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. He's quoting the Bible. Satan knows the Bible just like we know the Bible. Well, guess what? Leviticus 20 and verse 10. You know what Satan knew? The penalty for murder and adultery is death. Leviticus 20 and verse 10 says, and the man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, even he that committeth adultery with his neighbor's wife and the adulterer, or the adulterer and the adulteress, shall surely be put to death. You think about Satan figures, I've got him. I mean, right here, I've got a verse that says flat out, he shall surely be put to death. He's an adulterer. I've got him, right? And if that's not enough, he's got him for murder too. Leviticus 24 and verse 17. Leviticus 24 and verse 17. It says, and he that killeth any man shall surely be put to death. Guaranteed. David's dead to rights. How's he possibly going to get out of this? David, the royal lineage hasn't been born of David yet. Solomon, his son that is going to be the father of the Messiah, he hasn't been born yet, right? So Satan's got him. He just kills David, and there the line of the Messiah is gone. How is God going to get out of this one? The thing is, the Lord put away his sin. Now you might think, well, this isn't fair. I mean, this is God's just not playing fair here. God is actually playing fair. But Satan didn't know how God could make this move and do so fairly. But I'll explain to you how that is. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 13. Because you think God's own word says that David has to be put to death. How is God not going to be forced to do that? 2 Samuel 12 and verse 13. And David said unto Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said unto David, the Lord also hath put away thy sin. Thou shalt not die. Now, how could the Lord have put away his sin? How could he do that? Jesus Christ, right? Jesus died for David's sins. Jesus took the penalty for David's sins. Jesus became that murderer, David. Jesus became that adulterer, David, and bore that sin. And David didn't have to die. That was God's prerogative to not cause David's physical death because Jesus died for his sins. Satan didn't know that. Right? He thought he had David. No way of getting out of this one. But he didn't know that. So he's really close this time, but he failed. Then he tries some other ways with David. David's son Absalom, he tries to take his throne, but he's unsuccessful. I'm not going to go to those verses, but I think you know that story. His son Absalom with the long hair, you know, the rebellious type, and he was a good politician and stood around and told everybody that, hey, you know, if basically, vote for Absalom, I'll make your wildest dreams come true. You know, it's going to be justice and judgment, and there's going to be no more of this, you know, lack of transparency in the government here, and all of your problems are going to be solved. You just come to me, vote for Absalom, everything's going to be all right. Now, that didn't work out so well for Absalom. Thankfully, was it Joab? I think it was Joab that killed Absalom. I think it was Joab. Anyway, David was such a softy. David was a bad father. You know that? You think about David, great king, bad father, terrible father. He never displeased his children at any time. And he just didn't tell them no, and he let Absalom just run roughshod. And even when Absalom was rebelling against him and trying to take the kingdom from him and ultimately kill him, David told the men, take Absalom alive, don't kill him. Absalom should have been killed for sedition and rebellion and all kinds of stuff. And thankfully, I think it was Joab, had enough sense just to kill him because he knew David wouldn't do it. And then David wept whenever he found out he was dead. But anyway, that didn't work out. And then Satan tries one last thing to destroy David. In 1 Chronicles 21 and verse 1, and now this one, some of these ones I've been reasoning. A lot of this I've been reasoning that Satan was behind this. But this one, I'm not reasoning. I can prove it to you, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about whenever you read the verse. 1 Chronicles 21 and verse 1. 1 Chronicles 21:1. And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. So there you go. There's no speculation about this. Satan provoked David to number Israel. Now, I don't know if you remember or not, but a while back, not that long ago, I did a Bible study on this passage here when David numbered Israel. And you wonder at the time, and I'll just briefly review this in case you've forgotten or for the sake of somebody that didn't hear it, but you wonder, why God's punishment for this sin, the numbering of the people of Israel, why would this punishment have been so severe? Because David was given three options, and none of them were good. What were the three options? 3 years famine, 3 months destroyed before thy foes, or 3 days with the sword of the Lord. And neither of those were going to be good. They were going to be severe. And David chose to go into the Lord's hand. And the Lord killed 70,000 men. 1 Chronicles 21:14. 70,000 men died because David numbered the people of Israel. And you think, what's the big deal? David took a census and 70,000 men died. Why? Why would that be? Well, the best that I can figure, and I mean, you can listen to the Bible study where I really prove this, but is that kings conducted censuses, basically numbered the people because they wanted to know how many soldiers they had prepared to go to war. And this is what David was doing. He was numbering the men that were old enough to go to war that drew sword. You can read about that there in verse 5. So he's trying to figure out how many soldiers he has, capable men, because he wants to wage a war of aggression. And God judged him severely for this bellicosity. There's a big one for you. For his, I'm trying to think of a synonym anyway. Bellicosity is like whenever you're just being belligerent towards other people and trying to kill them and take them over. Bellicosity, just think U.S. government, then you'll always remember what the word means. But anyway, 70,000 people died for this. And once again, you wonder, okay, and David wondered, why do these 70,000 die and I don't die? Why don't you take it out on me? He asked the Lord to do. And once again, you know, David was the Lord's man, and he put away David's sin. But anyway, Satan just about had him again. But the Lord delivered him. By this point, Solomon was born already. So the lineage of the Messiah would have continued even if David would have been killed. But here's the thing. Satan didn't know that Solomon was the promised son yet. So he still had a chance. You know, I may as well take out David if I can, because I don't know, you know, speaking as Satan, who the promised Messiah will come through just yet. So that brings us down to Solomon. So David had Solomon through Bathsheba. Actually, strangely enough, you'd wonder, because David had like 7 wives, why would God bring the Messiah through the wife that he had through adultery? But I don't know. Go ask God about it. I don't know. Because God uses a line of sinners to bring about the Messiah, I guess. Like Phares, that was born of fornication. Judah went into what he thought was a harlot, which was actually his daughter-in-law of his deceased son, and he had promised her his other son, and when the other son gets old enough to become her husband, he didn't give him to her, so she comes up with a little plan, dresses up like a whore, and he goes into her, and she's smart enough to take his rings and his signet and his staff, and she gets pregnant, and Judah finds out about it. And he says, you're going to burn that whore. I mean, she's not going to live. We're not going to have reprobate sinners like that around here. And she says, oh, okay. Well, whoever these signets are is the guy that knocked me up. And he's like, oh, crap. Well, that's me. So I guess, never mind. We won't burn you after all. But anyway, so that Phares was born of that fornication. And Phares was in the lineage of the Lord Jesus Christ. So I don't know. That's the way God does things. That's the one thing I ever learned from a Catholic priest, as a matter of fact. I went to a Mass one time, midnight Mass, Christmas Eve, because my mother's family's Catholic. This is a long, long time ago when I was a kid. And the priest got up there, and he was reading through one of the genealogies, either Matthew or Luke. I don't remember which one. And of course, you know, you're 12 years old, and this Catholic priest is up there droning on through genealogies. So-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so. I'm like, oh, get on with it. I mean, what? What is the point? And his point was that Jesus comes from a long line of sinners. And you know, it's funny. I don't hardly remember anything that my pastor ever preached for like 20 years that I was in the Christian Missionary Alliance Church, but I remember what that Catholic church, what that Catholic priest preached way back then. That always stuck with me for some reason. But anyway. So David has said that Solomon is going to be his son that's going to reign in his stead. So now the field's narrowed down again. Now Satan knows which son of David it's going to be. 1 Kings 1 and verse 13. 1 Kings 1 and verse 13. says, go and get thee in unto King David, and say unto him, didst not thou, my lord, O king, swear unto thine handmaid, saying, assuredly, Solomon thy son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon thy throne. Why then doth Adonijah reign? See, remember, David's a bad father. It says there in 1 Kings 1:6, and his father had not displeased him at any time, saying, why hast thou done so? David never displeased Adonijah. And now when David's on his deathbed, ready to die, and he said that Solomon's going to be the king, Adonijah decides that he's going to be the king. So out of all of David's kids, he had two of them that tried to take the throne from him and usurp his authority. You can learn a lot from King David, learn a lot from his Psalms, and learn a lot from his life, but I would not model your parenting after King David because he did not do a good job. You know, it's weird. A lot of the great men of God were horrible fathers. Eli was a horrible father and really great guy, right? Loved the Lord, loved the service of the Lord and the Ark of the Covenant and all that. But Eli didn't restrain his sons. He knew what was going on there and he didn't restrain them. He said to you guys, hey, why are you guys doing this? This is bad. And they didn't pay any attention to him. He didn't restrain his kids. And guess what? His kids died and the Ark of the Covenant was taken and Eli fell over in his chair and broke his neck, died. Samuel, and maybe he learned it from Eli, Samuel was not a good father either, I presume anyway, because it said his sons walked not in his ways. It's possible that he did a really good job and his kids just didn't follow in his ways. I guess that's possible, but kind of seems like probably didn't, right? Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. So Samuel didn't, his sons didn't walk in his ways, and that's why the people wanted a king, because his sons were corrupt. So anyway, you have examples. Lot was a just man, and yet he was a terrible father. His kids paid no attention to him whatsoever and ended up dying in Sodom because of it. And then Lot ends up fathering Ammon and Moab through an incestuous relationship with two of his daughters. I mean, this guy was a terrible father, yet he was a child of God. But anyway, so it's weird that, you know, a lot of the great men of God were not good fathers. So despite Adonijah's scheme, getting back to him, despite his scheme, Solomon ended up inheriting David's throne. Because I didn't read there verse 5, but it says there in 1:5, then Adonijah the son of Haggith exalted himself, saying, I will be a king, and he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. So despite all this, Solomon still ends up becoming the king in 1 Kings 1 and verse 39. 1 Kings 1:39. And Zadok the priest took an horn of oil out of the tabernacle and anointed Solomon, and they blew the trumpet, and all the people said, God save King Solomon. So despite all of Satan's efforts to try to get Solomon not on the throne, because after all, he doesn't want the Messiah to come through Solomon, Solomon still ends up on the throne. So now the field is narrowed, and Satan knows that he's got to work on Solomon. And it appears that Satan went right to work against Solomon, corrupting him through outlandish women, causing him to sin. So Solomon is the man, right? God's given him wisdom and knowledge exceeding above all men. And Solomon's got it all. And Satan goes to work against him and uses outlandish women to get him to sin. 1 Kings 11:4 through 8. I don't think this is any great wonder that Solomon did exactly what he wasn't supposed to do and multiplied women unto himself, multiplied horses unto himself, multiplied silver and gold unto himself, like God said the king was not supposed to do. I don't think it's any great wonder that Satan was working on Solomon, trying to destroy him and trying to destroy the line of the Messiah. 1 Kings 11:4-8. And it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, and was as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father. Then did Solomon build an high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, which burnt incense and sacrificed unto their gods. It says in Nehemiah 13 that outlandish women did cause him to sin. Now, who do you suppose was behind this? Who was behind getting him to worship these false gods? Well, you remember that the gods of the nations are devils, right? 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 20, Paul said, "The things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice unto devils and not to God." So Satan is having Solomon worship him. Makes sense, right? God has said that Solomon is the one that the Messiah is going to come through, and Satan now has Solomon worshiping him, the devil. Makes sense, right? He's trying to get Solomon away from God into him. The Lord was angry at Solomon for this, and he did rent the kingdom. He took away 10 tribes from Solomon, and he only left 2 with Solomon, or with Solomon's son, Rehoboam. Rehoboam kept Judah and Benjamin, and then the other 10 tribes were given to a man named Jeroboam. Look at 1 Kings 11, 9 through 13. 1 Kings 11, 9 through 13. "And the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. And he commanded him concerning this thing that he should, that he should not go after other gods. But he kept not that which the Lord commanded. Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, for as much as this is done of thee, and thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and will give it to thy servant." And that's exactly what happened. He gave it to his servant. Let me just keep reading there. Verses 12 to 13. "Notwithstanding, in thy days I will not do it for David thy father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son." So because David was such a good king, he wouldn't do it for David's sake. He wouldn't take it out of Solomon's hand for David's sake, but he would do it out of Solomon's son's hand. "Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but will give one tribe for thy son, to thy son for David my servant's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen." So once again, Satan has managed to get God very angry with Solomon, with the man through whom the Messiah is going to come, and God judges him, but not totally, right? He still reserves Judah for himself, the tribe of Judah. Remember, that's the tribe that the Messiah is going to come through. So he still has Judah for himself. He still has a decent line of kings that will produce the Messiah. The kings after the line of Jeroboam were a bunch of wretches, and there were very few, hardly any good kings in the kingdom of Israel, in the northern kingdom. But in the southern kingdom, in the kingdom of Judah, through Rehoboam, though Rehoboam wasn't a good guy, but there were a lot of good kings in that lineage. And if you look through the kings of Judah, if you just read through the books of Kings and Chronicles, and I'm not going to do that right now, obviously, in the interest of time, but if you see that, you're going to see Satan's continued assaults against the kings of Judah. And he does his best to corrupt them, and he does corrupt some of them. And at various times, they were very corrupt, and then God would raise up a good king in their stead. Sometimes even the son of a corrupt king would be a good king, and God would still be ultimately fulfilling his purpose and not allowing the lineage of the Messiah to be so corrupted that it would be destroyed. I'm not going to finish up the rest of this outline. I didn't know if I was going to get to it or not, and I'm not going to get to it today. We'll look at it next time. But there is a time in this lineage of the kings, and this is where it gets really fascinating, and we will cover this next time, Lord willing, when Satan manages to kill the entire bloodline, the entire royal bloodline of the Messiah, except for one baby boy. There were, I think it was 70 kids, if I remember right. Anyway, there were a whole bunch of kids of the royal line, of the kingly line, and this woman named Athaliah kills the entire seed royal except for one little baby, and the only reason she didn't kill him is because she didn't get to him. And that little baby ends up preserving the lineage of the Messiah. One little baby. It was down to one single baby, and Satan had to have thought that he had just about won it. Anyway, we'll talk about that next time, Lord willing, and then we will get to probably the most interesting part of the study, and that's when the battle intensifies, when the Lord Jesus Christ is born and all of the powers of darkness are unleashed and the battle really rages heavy. And so that'll be interesting stuff, Lord willing.